Hello, everyone. My name is Sally Cragen, and I am here with my friend Paula Giaquinto. And, excuse me, we are here for the second poetry podcast with Paula and Sally. Welcome, Paula.
Well, nice to see you, Sally. It's great to be back, and I'm really looking forward to today's reading and discussion. Again, celebrating language and some wonderful familiar poems. So let's get started.
Absolutely. So our first poet is a favorite of both of ours, a man named Robert Louis Stevenson, and his dates are 1850 to 1894. He did not live for a very long time, but during his lifetime, he did incredible accomplishments in the literary world, best known as the author of Treasure Island and also The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I mean, he invented characters that are still being talked about, being dramatized, and, you know, very present in modern culture today.
Mm-hmm. When I was a very young child, my first standalone book of poetry was Giles Garden of Verses, Robert Louis Stevenson. And, you know, it was a nightly reading with my mom, and then a book I would go to for many years because the poems were just so sweet, sweet. And then only as an older reader did I come to realize the background of the author, which was shed a different light on the meaning of the poems or how I came to understand them. And could appreciate them even more.
I think that the poems we're going to read today are poems that may well be familiar to you, the reader. And we're going to start with My Shadow. My Shadow by Robert Louis Stevenson. I have a little shadow that goes in and out with me, and what can be the use of him is more than I can see. He is very, very like me, from the heels up to the head, and I see him jump before me when I jump into my bed. The funniest thing about him is the way he likes to grow, not at all like proper children, which is always very slow. For he sometimes shoots up taller than an India rubber ball, and he sometimes gets so little that there's none of him at all. He hasn't got a notion of how children ought to play, and can only make a fool of me in every sort of way. He stays so close beside me, he's a coward, you can see. I'd think shame to stick to Nursie as that shadow sticks to me. One morning, very early, before the sun was up, I rose and found the shining dew on every buttercup. But my lazy little shadow, like an arrant sleepyhead, had stayed at home behind me and was fast asleep in bed. That was My Shadow by Robert Louis Stevenson.
Mm-hmm. Interesting that, you know, it's clearly written by an adult, but putting himself back into that child sense of wonder at something as ordinary as a shadow. And you think about all of the childhood games, Cat's Cradle or Hopscotch or Foursquare, or the ways young and sometimes very young children entertain themselves when they're on their own or kind of just walking alongside an adult or a parent or a nurse, and wondering about how the world works. And there's a shadow. And what does it mean? And it's his. I just think that's just a beautiful point of view, and not one that personally I as an adult often put myself in that place.
I think that it's really easy for me as an adult to kind of overlay his biography, his sickly childhood, his sort of intermittent school. He's got a wonderful poem about, you know, being in bed and the counterpane becomes an ocean. But his sensitivity is really what's extraordinary. And like so many of those Victorians, he fit so much in his life. I found a little biographical snippet. He had attended school since he was 7, but he had irregular attendance. And when he was 16, he entered university. His plan was to become a lighthouse engineer like his father. Again, that's a really solitary job, which I think every writer really kind of pursues or needs. But he didn't apply himself at school, and he became known for his outrageous dress and behavior. And his nickname at college was Velvet Jacket, because he always had a wide-brimmed hat and a boy's velveteen coat. And in the company of his cousin Bob, he also would be smoking hashish and visiting brothels when he explored the seamier side of Edinburgh, which is where he was from. But he eventually did study law and trained himself to be a writer by imitating the style of other writers. I think that, again, for his long-term, you know, illnesses, he had to develop this imagination as well. And he's someone who I think people don't take seriously in this century, much as they don't take, like, Longfellow seriously. Mm-hmm. It's almost like they wrote too much. But anyway, we are focusing on Child's Garden of Verses, poetry of Robert Louis Stevenson, in this poetry podcast with Paula and Sally. So
I have one as well, and it's called To Any Reader. So this is To Any Reader by Robert Louis Stevenson. As from the house your mother sees you playing round the garden trees, so you may see, if you will look through the windows of this book, another child far, far away, and in another garden play. But do not think you can at all, by knocking on the window, call that child to hear you. He, intent, is all on his play business bent. He does not hear, he will not look, nor yet be lured out of this book. For long ago, the truth to say, he has grown up and gone away. And it is but a child of air that lingers in the garden there.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, it's kind of a sweet, I don't know, is it about a, I wonder, is it about an imaginary friend, or is it about a longing for that child that maybe he never had a chance to be? Going back to what I was talking about, it, as an adult, I think being around children and understanding children, you know, I was a teacher for my whole career, and it was always interesting to try and put yourself, that empathizing in the mind of that child and how they learned or how they thought or what they felt or how they socialized. But, you know, as an adult, life takes its own course and you get busy, and that childlike wonder and questioning and interests. That's something I, you know, it's, you could long for it. And that's what I see in this poem. You know, it's, he's grown up and gone away. And it is but a child of air that lingers in the garden there. So there's a longing for that, to return to childhood or miss childhood. I wonder, you know, he'd be a guy I'd invite for cocktails on a Saturday to chat. What were you thinking when you wrote this? What did it mean?
The word nostalgia comes from the Greek root nostos, which means homecoming. And I think Robert Louis Stevenson, he was very widely traveled in pursuit of good health. And so, remember, this is a guy who invented Long John Silver.
There you go. Yeah.
So he had, I think he had full access to the innocence of a child, but he also knew that, you know, kids are kind of up to trying to manage the world and understand the world as well. So he's there's a lot more there. And don't forget, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yeah, you're right. It's just interesting that writers can, whether it's poetry or short stories or novels, can take on that. It's an intellectual exercise to write their work, but it's kind of an emotional and psychological exercise to understand what it would take to be that character. So whether it's a character of a child sick in bed, living his world through a book with imaginary friends, or being Dr. Jekyll.
Right. And I think that...
Interesting.
It is. And the last podcast we did where we read from The Raven and talked about Edgar Allan Poe, the really complex, like, modern psychology that we understand today in a post-Freudian, post-Jungian world, these guys were totally onto it.
Like, yeah, that's a good point. And I don't know if that was before they were ahead of their times, or that was in the time, because the Victorian era, whether it was romantic poets or Edgar Allan Poe as a gothic, I mean, a real, true gothic storyteller in poetry and other forms, there was clearly an aura during that period that allowed him to feel he could contribute. Now, a lot of those authors weren't really paid well or rewarded during the time they wrote, but there was something in the air. There had to have been, or something in the water, or something in the wherever they went for libations. But interesting.
Well, in the case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Stevenson had an argument with his wife after he drafted it, because his wife was not, praising of the manuscript. He then threw it in the fire, and he rewrote it in 3 days.
Oh,
and it sold 40,000 copies in the first 6 months. And this is an era, I remember reading a statistic where Virginia Woolf had a bestseller because it sold 2,000 copies in 1920, whatever. So the vast literacy of basically Western Europe and North America definitely, made it possible for writers to make a living.
Right.
I think we've got another Stevenson poem also. And again, you're listening to Poetry Podcast with Paula and Sally.
Do you have one, Sal?
Oh, I thought you had one.
I had my reader.
All right. Well, we're gonna finish our Stevenson discussion with the reader.
That's what I just read.
Oh, sorry. You know what? This is number two, so we're going to ask our audience to be forgiving.
Oh, yeah.
So just for those who are keeping track, Stevenson died, again, very young, in his 40s, and he died on the island of Samoa. He left unfinished a book called The Weir of Hermiston, and he was buried at the summit of Mount Vea on the island of Samoa. He had traveled the world before Samoa. He'd been at Saranac Lake, New York. And I just want to, tip our hat to the amazing man that was Robert Louis Stevenson. Mm-hmm. Now we are moving on to, we've got some sonnets, I believe.
Yes. I have Sonnet 43 by Elizabeth Barrett Browning. And again, to launch our podcast, we're really looking for and thinking about poems that might be familiar and accessible. And this is a shift, a little more adult. But again, that 19th century motif. And these lines may be familiar. So I will read Sonnet 43 by Elizabeth Barrett Browning. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach when feeling out of sight for the ends of being and ideal grace. I love thee to the level of every day's most quiet need by sun and candlelight. I love thee freely as men strive for right. I love thee purely as they turn from praise. I love thee with a passion put to use in my old griefs and with my childhood's faith. I love thee with a love I seem to lose with my lost saints. I love thee with the breath, smiles, tears of all my life. And if God choose, I shall but love thee better after death. Sonnet 43 by Elizabeth Barrett Browning.
What a remarkable lyricist she is, and how plain spoken that poem is. Mm-hmm. It's really simple language. There's no fancy words. There's so much passion. And I think, you know, just a bit of biography on EBB. She had read Greek and Roman histories that were in her home before the age of 10. So we're talking major prodigy, like really, really sharp. And I think avid curiosity as well. But the, you know, to write like that about love and to write that like that, you know, almost as an equal, I think is, you know, really unprecedented in that time, because it's something, I mean, we still say that poem, we still hear that poem at weddings.
Right. And it's a way to think about love, you know, and it seems so modern, let me count the ways. And then it's not counting by number, but counting by, like, and she uses the words depth and breadth and height. So it's more of an illusion of counting, but then goes on to delineate all of the ways, sun and candlelight, freely, striving for right, purely, passionately, love that, with a love I seem to lose with my lost saints. That's such a turn of phrase that, what does that mean? You know, it's not a Valentine candy kind of love. It kind of hints at, you know, that sort of religious wondering about what does this mean for your soul? And then, of course, at the end, and if God choose, I shall but love thee better after death. So that whole thing, till death do us part, doesn't work here. You know, that love is going to stay for as long as I'm alive. I just think that's a simple, it rhymes, it seems straightforward, but it's a pretty deep way to think about a word we bandy around in very, you know, in song lyrics or, you know, just contemporary social media. I love this. I love you. You know, commercials on television. I mean, don't Subarus love drive the love or whatever it is they advertise? That's not this poem.
It isn't. And she, I think with her complexity, and again, we have another sickly childhood. Barrett Browning was injured from a horseback and, you know, spent basically the rest of her life in bed. And when you're forced into a life of the mind, I just think it's so interesting that she doesn't fall into, and she's not the same, she's a little bit older than Queen Victoria. Her dates are 1806 to 1861. But she was recognized in her lifetime as a successful poet, and she really stood up for the Italians. She was widely traveled, very much a romantic who's almost so big that sometimes she gets overlooked in favor of her husband, mm-hmm. Robert Browning. So I actually have a Elizabeth Barrett Browning poem as well. I think this is not very long, but it's written in quatrains. I'm sorry, it is actually written in six-line stanzas, and there are seven of them. And again, the rhythms of our Victorian poets are always very important. This is A Musical Instrument by Elizabeth Barrett Browning. 1. What was he doing, the great god Pan, down in the reeds by the river? Spreading ruin and scattering ban, splashing and paddling with hooves of a goat, and breaking the golden lilies afloat with the dragonfly on the river. 2. He tore out a reed, the great god Pan, from the deep cool bed of the river. The limpid water turbidly ran, and the broken lilies a dying lay, and the dragonfly had fled away, ere he brought it out of the river. 3. High on the shore sat the great god Pan, while turbidly flowed the river, and hacked and hewed as a great god can, with his hard bleak steel at the patient reed, till there was not a sign of a leaf, indeed, to prove it fresh from the river. 4. He cut it short, did the great god Pan, how tall it stood in the river, then drew the pith like the heart of a man, steadily from the outside ring, and notched the poor, dry, empty thing in holes as he sat by the river. 5. This is the way, laughed the great god Pan, laughed while he sat by the river. The only way, since gods began to make sweet music, they could succeed. Then dropping his mouth to a hole in the reed, he blew in power by the river. 6. Sweet, 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 O Pan, piercing sweet by the river, blinding sweet, O great god Pan, the sun on the hill forgot to die, and the lilies revived, and the dragonfly came back to dream on the river. 7. Yet half a beast is the great god Pan, to laugh as he sits by the river, making a poet out of a man. The true gods sigh for the cost and pain, for the reed which grows nevermore again as a reed with the reeds in the river. That was A Musical Instrument by Elizabeth Barrett Browning.
Well,
I kind of surprised Paula with that.
Yeah.
I popped it in just thinking when we have poems and poets, it's good to hear more than one. Because the sarcasm in this is so beautifully put together, that splashing and paddling with hooves of a goat, spreading ruin and scattering ban, the great god Pan is a bit of a lummox. And then he pulls up the reed and he frightens the dragonfly and he makes holes in it and then he blows in it and then he wins. He creates music.
Yeah, well, and I like the language. The river is very important. It's repeated over and over.
Yes,
by the river, in the river, or on the river. I like the sweet, sweet, sweet. So sometimes when you read poetry, every line, every stanza is different, except for the rhyme, but that playfulness of language seems to match or align really nicely with what we know, or who we know Pan is in legend.
Yes.
So there's, you know, and the dragonfly came back. So there's a great little story there too, which I think is, it's interesting because it's not the deep sort of thoughtful, meditative connections around love. It's Pan and playfulness with something like music. So that, you're right, Sally, having more than one poem by an author, a poet, it gives you an interesting, the opportunity for an interesting sort of survey of their creative thinking and the results. You know, it's that playfulness wasn't really evident in her sonnet.
You know, it wasn't, but at the same time, the I think the tenderness in the sonnet, there's a sort of tenderness here. Her line about, yet half a beast is the great god Pan to laugh as he sits by the river, making a poet out of a man.
Yeah.
I mean, who else did that? And then she writes, the true gods sigh for the cost and pain, for the reed which grows never more again as a reed with the reeds in the river. And it's about how sometimes to make art, there needs to be some destruction that goes on. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I lived in Cambridge, I met so many PhDs who were driving cabs, right? Like, to get this great education, you know, it comes at a cost. But I think that, you know, the great Barrett Browning, the sun on the hill forgot to die.
That's a great line. That's a great line. But you're right. The creative process comes at a cost.
It does.
Sometimes it's a disruptive thought. Sometimes it's a sacrifice somebody, the artist, has to make in order to dedicate their life to this work. Sometimes it's a point of view or a belief that isn't shared by other people, like Robert Louis Stevenson's wife, who wasn't fond of his work, and it ended in the fire.
Yes.
But that's interesting. That's kind of like I don't know if it's a universal truth, but it's often true. Yeah.
So we are coming to the end of episode number 2, yeah. If you can believe it, Paula.
That time flies.
It flies. Again, you can reach out to us by contacting or going on Facebook, Creative Writing New England. We will create a Facebook page for Poetry Podcast. But for now, just reach out to us on Creative Writing New England. Again, there are some folks to thank. Of course, FATV, the best local cable shop. I mean, now they're podcasts and cable shows. Especially Keith and Nate, thanks for all your support. Thank you, Paula Giaquinto, for being being willing to be part of this, but also to have such great instincts. We welcome your comments, you listeners and watchers. I'd also like to play us out with a little bit of music from my brilliant brother, Hal Cragen. This is from Morgan Memorial, a new release, and that's Hal, last name Cragin, and we thank you for visiting, and we'll see you really soon.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you, Sally. Another great afternoon.